Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Friday, September 18th, 2015. It is the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected each week by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week, my experts are Sharon Burke, senior advisor at the New America Foundation, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs. Sharon, it's great to see you, my friend. How are you?
Oh, it's great to be back here. It always is great to be here.
Thank you very much for coming in. And I want to hear about your new deal that I read about. You sent me an email about it this week, and I want to learn more about that.
Great.
Later on in the program, Ron Sanders, Vice President and Fellow at Booz Allen Hamilton and former Chief Human Capital Officer of the Intelligence Community, among other jobs. Ron, thanks very much for coming in. It's good to see you as always.
Always good to do this on a Friday.
I appreciate it. And you have each chosen what you think are the three most important federal news stories of the week. And we start where we always do with... Come on, people.
Number three.
Still trying to get used to having to do this in the morning. Sharon, your choice at number three. That's right. Well, they've asked for a different scale. Like they want to tear up the contract and start over. I don't know what the deal is with that. Sharon, your choice at number three is from Vox. And it has to do with what I thought was one of the silliest questions at the Republican debate the other night. And that is, what woman would you put on the $10 bill? I don't like the whole discussion in the first place. But what was it about this question that caused you to want to choose this?
Now, to be fair, I agree with you. It was a silly question in the sense that it was almost like this Monty Python, what's your favorite color? You know, blue? I don't know. Right. So it was a little bit like that. And I think everybody chokes at those kinds of questions. But and I don't mean to reduce the importance of the overall topics of the debate, because we could be looking at the next president of the United States and what they have to say on the full range of topics, you know, and especially I think on national security was interesting, significant, and to my mind, very troubling. I heard a lot of things that worried me, and I understand this is a different kind of discussion. But this moment, which I think is often the case in debates where someone asks a somewhat frivolous question, but it reveals things you're not expecting. And for me, I mean, I'm a defense professional. I'm not a suffragette, you know, but I like having the vote. And what was stunning to me was that so many of these people just were left completely flat-footed. They could not think of a significant American woman. And it just, it made me sad. It made me sad that someone that might be my president cannot think of a single significant American woman. And I'm glad that their mothers and wives and daughters are significant to them. But, you know, If that's the kind of president that they're going to be, that they put their family on the currency, then we're really in trouble.
John Kasich chose Mother Teresa, who isn't even
American.
American
citizen. You know, wonderful woman.
Yeah.
A saint,
love her.
Right?
And who was it that chose Margaret Thatcher?
That was Jeb Bush.
Yeah.
Which I was just like, oh. Now, to be charitable, I could construe that as a statement that we haven't yet had an American executive, you know, a president of the United States that's female. And so he doesn't have someone of that caliber to point to in our own history. And I would have accepted it even if he'd said that. If he'd said, I wish I could point to someone, and I'm going to change that. You know, I'm going to make sure my party puts women of significance and character in important positions.
Ron, the debate focused on a lot of issues on national security and things like that that Sharon talked about. My takeaway was that I think maybe the folks at CNN that were asking the questions, that were forming the questions, gave the American people a lot more credit than I probably would have that they care about that stuff at this point in the conversation. Maybe that's good. Maybe I'm misreading what the average person thinks about what we're doing in the national security community here in Washington and all around the world. But that I was kind of surprised by the fact that there was that much discussion at all about that stuff.
I'm not sure I was surprised. I was gratified because I do think that signals a shift in the campaign from entertainment to something of a bit more substance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I'd go so far as to say we're there yet. We're at the substantive stage yet. But we certainly were in transition. And, you know, we're still having candidates play for the cameras. And I think the American people understand that, but there was some substance there. There were some differences between the candidates on their approach to national security.
Sharon, the only one that the question I thought was sillier was the question of what would your code name be? I mean, as somebody in the media, I hear questions like that and I go, no wonder nobody thinks we have any sense.
You know, and I you know what they're trying to do, right?
Yeah, they're trying to introduce,
because everything is so, a lot of those folks up there, you know, had very Teflon answers, right?
Mm-hmm.
That were, and they were trying to introduce a little spontaneity. But, you know, and again, some pity for these poor folks. They're trying to hold a lot of information in their head. And they're trying to spar, and then to ask for spontaneity on top of it.
For 3 hours.
Right.
Well, and that's the, I think I tweeted at one point when they were, my role in tweeting this was just to put silly stuff out there that I wished people were saying. And afterwards, I think what I wrote about that when they asked Donald Trump something was that I've been standing there for 3 hours. I'd really like to go to the men's room because I didn't get any sense that there were really any breaks available for that kind of thing for 11 people to be standing there for 3 hours in a row.
Although, again, to be fair, I mean, I think one thing that you certainly see out of the president of the United States is that it's a job that takes a lot of fortitude. And you know, every president we've ever had, you've watched this progression of them dealing with this constant barrage of problems, and you watch them age tremendously in office. So seeing how you can answer under a 3 hour spotlight where you have to be really on your toes is probably not an unrealistic sort of condition for what it's like to be president. So it's fair.
Sharon Brooks' choice is the third most important federal news story of the week. What was really going on in that awkward debate moment about putting a woman on the $10 bill? It's from Vox, and it's at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The link posted there. Ron, your choice at number three is, how do you keep millennials from quitting the feds? It's from Federal Times. And this is an issue that you and I have talked about before. What I take away from this article, which is new, is it doesn't look like things are getting better. Like, it doesn't even look like there's incremental progress, unfortunately. Is that, am I being too dramatic about it or too harsh about it?
Unfortunately, no. I too am pessimistic. This is sort of the human capital equivalent of climate change. It's a little bit each year. It gets worse and worse each year. The employee viewpoint survey numbers go down each year. If you think of the campaigns, not just the debates, but the campaigns as a branding of the federal government, think about how that brand is being treated in the media and with the candidates, to be quite blunt about it. So if I'm somebody graduating from college this summer and I have some choices, and hopefully the best and brightest have choices, I look at the federal government and I say, now I'll date myself. Way back when I was working on my PhD for the original Volcker Commission, this was in the last century, I actually did a
the 20th, survey. Not the 19th, right?
20th, yes.
Okay.
I once claimed to Francis that I thought like a millennial, and he asked me whether that I was of the first millennium.
I say that?
Yes, you did.
Gotta watch what you say.
Because that's a great line, but I wouldn't have given myself credit for thinking of it.
I surveyed Honor Society inductees, engineering, business, Phi Beta Kappa. They all, this was in, again, late 80s, early 90s. They all wanted to make a difference. They said all the right things. They just didn't think the federal government was the place to do it. My bet is if you did that survey again today, you'd find very much the same thing, maybe worse. So it's not, we're both hemorrhaging the talent that we have, but frankly, I worry more that we're not attracting it. And I had the chance to listen to John Koskinen at a conference last week. And he allowed us how the IRS, 100,000 people, I used to be the HR director there, the number of people under 25 in that agency are less than a couple of hundred. I mean, that's pretty scary. That's your seed corn.
Mm-hmm. You saw this firsthand at the Defense Department. You're nodding your head in agreement as Ron's talking about this. And this problem, the solution has proven to be very elusive for agencies all across government, Sharon.
And I think to some degree, it's part of the character of the millennial generation, which is they move a lot. So, and the federal government doesn't allow that kind of flexibility to move in and out. And in my office that I ran, because it was a startup office, it was a pop-up office. It started up, it went down. As a pop-up office, we were able to bring in a fresh crew of people. And I did have a number of younger people in the office, of millennials, which was unusual because I was in the acquisition side of the house, which is a much older workforce. And they loved the work. They loved being there. But I couldn't keep them there because of the personnel policies and how inflexible it was and how hard it was to get people in, to keep them in. I mean, it took me 6 months once we had identified someone to actually get them in the door. And, you know, the ones that stayed loved the work, but they did not stay in the federal government because it was just the entire infrastructure for personnel was almost hostile to them. So they just didn't stay.
30 seconds, Ron. This is going to take ripping it out by the roots. It seems to me the longer and longer we go and the worse the problem gets. Am I off base there?
Yes, it's been intractable, but there are models. You mentioned the intelligence community. We transformed it in the 2000s. When I left, 60% of the 100,000 or so people that populate the 17 intelligence agencies were had 5 years or less of service. We specifically built programs to move them around within the community so they could scratch that itch. We had essentially an accepted service hiring authority. We're going to talk more about that later. That allowed us to get them in quickly. And once they were in with the clearance, they didn't want to leave because the work was so darn interesting. That's the model. It's elusive, but it's not rocket science.
Ron Sanders' choice is the third most important federal news story of the week is from the Federal Times. How do you keep millennials from quitting the feds? You can find that and all of our choices on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important stories is selected by Sharon Burke and Ron Sanders. It's the Federal News Countdown. You're listening to the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Sharon Burke and Ron Sanders, and we're up to
number 2.
Ron, your choice at number 2 this week's from GovExec. The headline is "Lawmakers Push for Immediate Back Pay for Feds If the Government Shuts Down." Now, we haven't gone through this shutdown issue too many times. We did it 2 years ago. We went through a lot of possibilities and maybes over the last several years. And then before that, it had been quite a long period of time. But this is the first time that I remember somebody suggesting up front, before the shutdown even happens, that if it happens, we should pay federal employees anyway. Every time somebody's come by afterwards and said we should take care of these people who, through no fault of their own, had to stay home. But what do you think makes the difference this time around? This is Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland who's leading this effort.
I think one of the differences this time, although this isn't necessarily unique, as you suggested, this is a bit of deja vu all over again. But in this year, the fight doesn't seem to be about the size of government. It's not so much. There's a little bit of this, but it's not so much about saving money. It's not about federal employees. It's not about the role of government. It's about something else. And I think as a consequence, it makes sense. I think this makes sense as a general matter because, as you've said, there has been no instance where back pay has not been provided after the fact. And if, you know, I could see a fight over this if, again, the debate was over payroll. It's not. It's about something else. So I think this is a laudable effort to hold the federal workforce harmless for somebody else's fight. I won't get into the nature of that fight.
News
right, news wrong, but hold them harmless. And I'll go back to our previous segment about recruiting millennials. I think this will help, especially as we begin now in the winter hitting campus and trying to recruit millennials, to be able to say, oh, yeah, that goes on in Washington, but we're protected.
Mm-hmm.
So I applaud it.
That's exactly where I was going to go with this, Sharon, which is one of the things that we see in the viewpoint surveys over and over again is the uncertainty how it makes engagement much more difficult for leaders, not just at the tops of the agencies, but further down in organizations. People who are leading teams that are much smaller than huge enterprises still say that all of the uncertainty and the gamesmanship, the brinksmanship, make engagement much harder.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, the message is unquestionably that you're not valued. And if you're not valued where you work and, you know, your service is considered so cheaply, then anybody who can find other work will. I mean, I did have an official at one point tell me, well, if they don't like it, they can leave. I said, well, that's exactly what's happening.
That's what's going on.
You know, and by the way, even though it wasn't a shutdown, we did have furloughs where people did not get back pay, and those were related to sequestration. So sometimes, you know, we had 1 year where we had the shutdown and furlough.
Mm-hmm.
And again, how am I supposed to keep, as a manager, talented people when we're telling them to go home like that? I mean, it's a terrible message to send. But what worries me here is that even though Senator Cardin has laudably put this forward, is that the problem is the federal workforce is important leverage. in this brinksmanship. So I don't think that it's going to pass. I hope it will. It's one thing when it's retroactive, right? But when it's at this point, there's still leverage hanging in the balance like this.
I will say that I'm going to stick with my estimation that I think there's only about a 25% probability that we'll actually have a shutdown. I think too much of the leadership is committed on both in both parties to keeping the doors open, that I'm not sure. I wrote 25% last week, and I think I'm going to keep it at about that. I'm not expecting agreement or disagreement with that. But I guess the frustration that I take away from something like this is, with all due respect to Senator Cardin, and I agree with you, Ron, that I think this is a good idea. It's hopefully will be wasted time and effort. It will be time and effort that he and his staff spent on something that will never and should never happen. And it's just indicative of what every single agency is going through right now.
Right. I think what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Yeah.
You know, you've had my colleague Bob Hale on here several times talking about what agencies go through, even if you buy the 25% chance,
yep,
relatively low odds, you still have to plan as if it were 100%, and people are uncertain, and it literally, you know, figuratively, if not literally, shuts the place down,
yep,
for, you know, a couple of weeks before and then a couple of weeks after. So I hope we can get past it. I remain optimistic, as you are, that the leadership will find a way. And again, I worry less about the politics of it and far more about the human capital implications, recruiting and retention. And the implications are significant.
Well, one example of what you're talking about is I was at an event that a group called Affirm hosted yesterday, and it was four CIOs or CIO-level officials. And the bulk of the conversation wound up revolving around, what are you going to do on cybersecurity if there's a shutdown? And after we've just gone through the OPM breach, it seems like a terribly unfortunate, I guess is the most reasonable word I can think of, situation to find ourselves in regarding what agencies are really doing to keep information secure. Ron Sanders' choice as the second most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec: lawmakers push for immediate back pay for feds if government shuts down. Sharon Burke, your choice at number two is from NBC News. It's about the floods in Utah, and it's a terrible story. But you pointed out when you sent the stories over that this was I think you sent over five or six links and essentially said all of the natural disasters that are going on right now, any one of those could have been what you chose here. And the thread that I took away from what you were pointing out was the managerial challenge of how you respond to all of these things that are happening simultaneously. Did I read that right between the lines?
Yes, you're very good at gleaning intent from
moments.
From lack of clarity. You know, one of the stories in there was that NOAA reported this week that this has been the hottest year on record since 1880, when records started being kept. And so we've got wildfires in California that are, you know, from my home state, that are raging out of control, freak floods in Utah. You know, this is what climate change looks like. Now, you can't say that any specific event, weather event, is climate change, because weather happens, it always has. It's the pattern over space and time. And what we are seeing is this pattern. And what's really interesting to me for this discussion is the burden that puts on governance and on response. First responders, but also, you know, communities, how they deal with this. It's a real challenge. And part of that challenge is, how do you get ahead of the curve? If these things are going to be happening more frequently and are going to be more severe, then we need to be looking at resilience nationwide and worldwide, really. And how do you make those investments earlier and sooner? And that's also a governance challenge, a different kind. But both on the front and the back end of this is something we've got to get our arms around.
There's a people governance challenge here, too, because in many cases, I know for law enforcement, and I believe for other kinds of first responders, there are mandatory retirement policies in place. And so the millennial issue that we just talked about a few moments ago is worse in some of these areas, I imagine, Ron.
It is. And, you know, at the risk of being a bit indelicate, those mandatory retirement laws were written literally in the last century, when people who were 50 were thought to be in the, you know, in the winter of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And these days they're not. So that's a that's one of several dozen human capital policies that ought to be revisited as the demographics change. But I'll add one other log to the fire. You and I have talked about this, the complexity of managing in an interagency environment, and in this case, it's not just interagency, it's intergovernmental.
Mm-hmm.
And I watch these unfold, and I do think we're starting to get that right. And I just wish we could bottle it and import it to more of day-to-day government where we face the same challenge, and it's still every agency for itself.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I see examples of when it really has to happen, that interagency and intergovernmental operation works okay, and then once the emergency is gone, people forget how to do it
right. And
kind of go back to the silo mentality. Sharon Burke's choice at number two on the countdown is a story from NBC News about the Utah floods, and you can find that and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The Federal News Countdown continues with the most important choices of the week next on Federal News Radio. This is the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. The three most important federal news stories of the week has selected this week by Ron Sanders and Sharon Burke, and we are up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Sharon Burke is from the New York Times. Chinese president's state visit has weighty agenda and busy schedule. And Xi Jinping, this story notes, arrives in the United States next week for his first state visit. He's the president and chief of the Communist Party in China. And he, of course, is not the only visitor that we'll have in D.C. next week. We're already being warned about what traffic nightmares we'll have as a result of Pope Francis visiting. I don't know if I'll get a chance to see him at all, but if I did, I would thank him for choosing the greatest name of any pope in the history of the Catholic Church.
Of course, it goes without saying.
Right.
But let's say it. Appreciate
I think it's absolutely wonderful.
But we will not start referring to you as Pope Francis.
No, don't do that, because then they'd make
Your
me
Eminence.
Wear that big tall hat. I think that would just be overdoing it a bit. What's the significance, though, of two leaders like this coming to Washington at the same time, Sharon?
Well, for the federal workforce, it's, as you said, it's going to be really hard to get to work.
Yeah.
Couldn't we schedule the shutdown at the same time?
Well, I mean, really, it could be a trifecta, right? It would be efficient to do it that way, right? Stay home anyway. I mean, Washington is going to be crazy next mm-hmm. week. And what's interesting, too, about it is this is history in the making and all coming to our streets. And it's, you know, it's history for our government. So this pope is like no other pope. And boy, do we not know what we're going to get when Pope Francis comes to America for the very first time. He's never been here before. And, you know, he's already shaken things up in all kinds of ways, including with his encyclical about climate change. So it'll be very interesting to hear what Pope Francis has to say to Washington, D.C., to the U.S. government. And I can bet you it's going to be eventful. And then we'll have this challenge for our entire federal workforce trying to figure out how to maneuver around a city that is... You know, it's not the federal government shutdown, but it is a city shutdown. Huge swaths of the city are going to be closed. So it will be an interesting week. And then right on his heels of this amazing historic visit where you can pretty much bet money. Of course, you wouldn't want to bet on the Pope, but you know what I mean. Bet money that Francis is going to say something
it
dramatic.
It seems seedy somehow to bet on the Pope.
Sounds bad, doesn't it? But
yeah.
He's an unconventional Pope.
No,
Jesuits
that's for sure.
are probably okay with that. And then you've got, you know, the Chinese president coming in. And there's a awfully big agenda for Xi Jinping when he gets here, and a state visit, and that's controversial in itself. Boy, do they have a big to-do list. And, of course, he's going somewhere else first, you know, mm-hmm. to Seattle.
Yes.
Because that's the real capital of the country, right? So having these two really historic visits, because so much rides on the U.S.-Chinese relationship right now, our economic well-being. We've got cybersecurity issues that are really, personally, I think we're already in a low-intensity conflict in cyberspace with China. These are all on the docket. And to have both of these leaders here at the same time ensnaring the city and the world's attention is just going to be quite a week.
Should the government have shut down, do you think, Ron? I mean, there's a lot of buzz about whether the agencies should just close because of all this traffic. And my sense is that when we look back after the Pope leaves, it's probably not going to turn out to be as bad as we've all. I think it's going to wind up being like a snowstorm where everybody thought this was going to be the worst thing that's ever happened. And then we got like an inch and a half. And it was inconvenient, but overall it was fine.
No, I was only being facetious before. I don't think we should shut the government down. In fact, I think that's the story behind the story here. Let's knock on wood a bit, but I think when that week, next week is over, one of the stories will be that government worked on.
Mm-hmm.
The security apparatus behind the scenes is eye-watering. The amount of interagency coordination that's going on for security as well as for the agenda for the Chinese visit with the Pope, the local law enforcement, and for the most part, agencies will be able to deal with that. They are telling people to telework, but that program, too, has come a long way. When I was at OPM more than a decade ago, it was just getting started, and we could never have said that with any confidence that we had the infrastructure in place to, for people to even do that.
Mm-hmm.
We do now. So I think, again, it's not going to make any headlines. It only makes headlines if something happens. But my bet is nothing's going to happen, and the real story will be it's because government employees came to work.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they came to work virtually. Sometimes they came to work physically. They did their jobs, and especially all of those involved in the various aspects of these visits. Kudos to them.
Sharon, I don't mean to hijack your story, but a sidebar here. Has telework in the government kind of hit a wall? A lot of people talked about it for a long period of time and how important it was going to be for COOP and all of those kinds of things. And I just don't hear a lot about telework or a prioritization of it. It's kind of fallen off the radar screen, and I wonder if I'm just not talking to the right people or if it's kind of hit a wall and it's reached the level of saturation that we can expect it to reach for the foreseeable future.
I mean, both at the State Department and at the Defense Department in service in both places, and State Department was within that 10-year window that you were mentioning, Ron, in both places I felt that we were actively discouraged from telework. And to some extent, that makes sense when you're in a defense environment because mm-hmm. some of the work requires you to be in a SCIF or at least in a secure location. So it's very difficult for it to be portable. But just as a policy matter, I think that the HR infrastructure was not encouraging people to telework. They did not make it easy.
I think largely managers have gotten over it. The sort of got to see them to manage them.
Mm-hmm.
Not completely, but largely. And frankly, I think the idea that it's not a big story anymore, again, knock on wood, next week should be fine, means that there are limits. Not every job is subject to telework.
Right.
Almost every job can be on a contingent basis, but on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis, so I do think you reach a limit when you've got, when telework has gone as far as it's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure we're there yet, but we may be pretty close. It's a maturing, you know, it's in its late adolescence.
And it may be mature enough then, and people may be on the other side of the continuum curve that telework is weird. And it, now that it is a more mature concept, people don't think of it as unusual. People think of it as maybe not the default yet, but closer to that than we've ever been before.
I'll tell you what, you go on campus and try to recruit a millennial and you say, we don't allow telework, they're going to leave the interview.
Instant two now. That's right.
I think we still have some education going on how to structure that and how to permit it so that it can be more useful.
Karen Burke's most important federal news story of the week is from the New York Times. Chinese president's state visit has weighty agenda and busy schedule. And there's a link to WTOP's frequently asked questions about the Pope's visit at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week is selected by Ron Sanders on In Depth with Francis Rose. Be right back. This is the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The three most important federal news stories of the week on the Federal News Countdown, selected by Sharon Burke and Ron Sanders. And Ron, your choice at number one is from the Washington Post. The headline is Pentagon Seeks Broad Changes in Pay Discipline and Other Policies for Civilian Employees. And this is the introduction of the Force of the Future effort that Undersecretary Brad Carson has been working on. A lot of conversation about this and how it relates to the national security personnel system. Give me, in 20 to 30 seconds, a recap of what NSPS is for people who don't remember what that was.
Well, that was DOD's first grand experiment in pay for performance. it had experimented sort of at the micro level in China Lake and in the laboratory community and the acquisition community. NSPS was designed to take it to scale, to cover most of the civilian workforce. And I guess the most notorious aspects of it involved abandoning tenure-based pay increases for something that was more performance-based. And truth in lending, I was deeply involved in it when I was at OPM, the OPM rep to the NSPS effort. And that was the reef upon which it foundered, that pay-for-performance aspect. And the kinks were never really worked out. So this is a bit of deja vu all over again. And I think what's most important, Francis, is to look at the root cause for this. Why again? And I think there was some method to the madness of my stories this week. If you look at millennials who are considering the federal government, in this case DOD, as a place to have a civilian career, and you look at things like a potential shutdown on one hand, which is more episodic, this is more systemic. If you have the choice between a Google or a Microsoft with state-of-the-art human capital policies that'll get you in quick, pay you what you're worth, give you a rich employment experience, and then you look at the kinds of rules that the federal government is saddled with. And again, per our earlier conversation, you can make a difference in the federal government. I truly believe that. But almost in spite of the rules, rather than rules or policies that enable. And I think I applaud what Secretary Carson is doing. I think this is a long time in coming. And what's not been written about nearly as much, but I think is just as important, maybe more so, are the changes he's proposed to the military personnel system.
When you looked at this, you lived this. So when you looked at this, Sharon, what did you see that you liked and what did you see that you weren't sure about, if anything?
Well, I like the fact that you have senior officials in the Pentagon who are digging into this, because I think one of the problems is that it requires someone at Brad Carson's level to make it happen. But often, you know, what's in your inbox is so consuming that the bandwidth just isn't there to take on this kind of fundamental change. And he is an exceptional leader. He's a smart guy and very creative and very determined. So I think I'm very optimistic. And also he knows this institution really well. He's not just parachuting in and saying, I'm going to fix everything. So I'm optimistic. I like that. I also like the idea of flexibility for managers. I think that's very important, and it's something that's definitely lacking, including in rewarding performance. As a manager in the department right now, you have very little ability to reward good performers and to recognize. And we were able to give very small increases or bonuses to like one person on the staff every year. So to be fair, I think if you look at all the research, what really motivates people is not necessarily money, though, right? It's the nature of the work, how much control you have over your work. And that's the one thing I would say that I don't like about this is that while we need a better personnel policy, and I'm glad the right people are paying attention to it, it's not enough. It's not like it's like a manager, a boss who mistreats people all year long and then gives them an award at the end of the year, thinking that that will be enough. It's not. You have to make sure that also that the jobs are worth having and that people are given meaningful work and have some control over what they're doing. And that is where I still have concerns about whether or not we're running the federal workforce, the Pentagon workforce, well beyond just the personnel policies.
So Sharon makes a really good point, Ron. If someone is prone, as you have said, as you are, to support this and to think this is a good idea, how much difference can this make on its own without a more holistic look at how not just the Defense Department, but every federal agency manages its workforce and hires and promotes and engages the people that work for it?
Look, a good leader can engage and motivate employees no matter how bad the system. I wish we had 100,000 good leaders. We don't. We have people who bring their lunchbox every day, and they struggle at this because the rules are so restrictive. I do think, though, that one of the things Secretary Carson has done here is really important and subtle. He would at least start with a more performance-based reward and compensation system with the department's managerial workforce. And I think that does two things. It tells the rank and file, We're going to try it on ourselves first. But it also gives the department the opportunity to really shape and reward good leadership, where today, if anything, it's subtly penalized. You get more headaches.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can structure the system so that good leaders are developed and rewarded and compensated accordingly, I agree, money is not a motivator. It is a differentiator.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm excelling as a leader, I should be that should be reflected in every way that we can possibly reflect it. So I think that's subtle. That's sort of bureaucratic jujitsu.
Mm-hmm.
That's a leverage point. He would also cover, I think, the cyber workforce and other aspects of the department's workforce that are not eligible for collective bargaining. But he also has reached out to the unions, and I think that's a good thing. They've got to come together and deal
with
this.
They didn't like it very much. He reached out to them, but they weren't really encouraged about it. The president of AFGE, J. David Cox, said this, talking about NSPS, this was one of the most spectacular failures in personnel management, and we object to these proposals being repackaged and sold to us again. I'll mark him down as undecided. The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Ron Sanders, is from the Washington Post. The headline is, Pentagon seeks broad changes in pay, discipline, and other policies for civilian employees. That and all of our stories on the Countdown archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Sharon Burke, it's great to see you. Tell me quickly, 30 seconds, about the work that you're undertaking with the Pew.
So I've just joined the Pew Project on National Security, Climate, and Energy as an advisor. I still also am at New America, which is a great think tank in town. And at Pew, we're going to be working on how to promote national security, that confluence of climate security, energy, and national security. They're a great outfit.
And congratulations on that. It's great to
thank
see
you.
Ron Sanders, always great to have you. Thank you for coming in,
thank you,
my friend. Great choices on the Countdown, and the Federal News Countdown returns next Friday on In-Depth with Francis Rose.